Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a board member for Pardes. In this year, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Torah portion Vayishlach. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's parsha is Parshat Vayishlach. We will be examining chapter 34, the story of the rape of Dinah. I am still on my U.S. lecture tour, so I apologize once again for the quality of this podcast. With God's help, I will be back in Israel so that next week the podcast schedule will return to normal. Our section begins, and Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she bore to Yaakov, went out to see among the daughters of the land. As we've mentioned on other occasions, the rabbis see this going out not in geographical terms, but existential ones. Leah is now leaving the bubble of her family. She is going out to explore her surroundings. Perhaps is becoming assimilated in her surroundings. The rabbis in a midrashic comment see this in a very negative light. They say that Dinah is following the model of her mother Leah. Leah was also someone who went out. In chapter 30, verse 16, we're told that when Yaakov comes back from the field, Leah goes out towards him and says, "Come to me, for I have hired you for the mandrakes or with the mandrakes of my son." Leah speaks to Yaakov in a way which is very immodest, and her daughter takes that one level higher. Despite that, in the next verse, we find that the response to her going out is a very cruel one. Shechem, the son of Hamor, the prince of the land, takes her, sleeps with her, afflicts her. And Nachmanides notes that afflicting her is a word which is appropriate for rape. Throughout this story, Dinah is silent. We do not have a clue as to what she is feeling, what she is thinking. And perhaps the silence underscores the fact that she has been now objectified. And we see this in a word which comes up a number of times in this section, in verse 5, it says, "And Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah," he being Shechem. The issue of defilement is at the core of this story. It is very interesting that we usually think of defilement in ritual terms. But in fact, from this story, we see that defilement at its core is an emotional, psychological, existential mode. I heard this many years ago from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Defilement has to do with a negation of one's divine image. In this story, Dinah has been violated. I mentioned earlier she has been objectified through the act of rape. But not only has she been violated through rape, but as we see in the continuation of the story, there are negotiations which are being held while she is being kept hostage. so that from beginning to end, she's been being treated as a thing. This is her defilement. She is not a human being. She is not someone who has a divine image. She is not someone who has a voice. She is something which is being bantered around by the people around her. This, in fact, is the tragedy of Dinah. After the story, we no longer hear of her. And in many ways, it seems that she has ceased to exist as a human being in the aftermath of this story. I would like to focus on the dynamics of the relationship between Shem, his father, and the family of Yaakov. In the negotiations that ensue, we are told in verse 3 that in the aftermath of this rape, Shem clings to the daughter of Yaakov. He loves the young maiden. He speaks to her heart. And if we would like to give Shem the benefit of the doubt, we could say that, in fact, rather than raping her and then tossing her out, Shem grows to love her. He perhaps tries to speak to her, to demonstrate to her his love. He would like to get her understanding. As I mentioned earlier, we do not see any response on the part of Dinah. She has no voice in the story. And perhaps we can infer from that she is not necessarily responsive to his overtures. And then we find, in verse 4, that Shem turns to his father, Hamor, and says, "Get me this girl to be my wife." As I mentioned, this is a very interesting response. Is it that Shem is perhaps afraid of the reaction of Yaakov and his family, so that he would like to get approval for this act to diffuse any political, military ramifications? Or is it that Shem has no reason to really fear the family of Yaakov, but is doing this as an act of decency to take or transform an illegitimate act and give it legitimacy? And from the story, at least at this point, there is no conclusive answer. What is really motivating Shem? Let us look further. What is the reaction of Yaakov's family? In verse 5, when Yaakov hears what happened, hears that his daughter was defiled, his response is silence. And it explicitly says he is silent until his sons return from tending to the sheep. In verse 7, we're told that when the sons coming from the field hear what happened, they are saddened. They are angry, very angry, because an abomination has been done in Israel. To sleep with the daughter of Jacob. Such a thing should not be done, cannot be tolerated. It is very interesting that at this point in the story, it seems to be that there are two different reactions. And perhaps we should keep that in mind. One reaction is sadness. And one could say that there is an element of sadness in terms of the personal tragedy. Their sister has been violated. They feel the pain that she has experienced. And we can see this at the very end of the section, when the brothers say in verse 31, Should he then treat our sister like a prostitute? It seems that their sister has been violated, and that is very painful. But perhaps what gets them exceedingly angry is the principle. The principle that this is something which is a violation of the family of Yaakov, something which is totally unacceptable in their midst, by their standards. An act which cannot be forgiven, and perhaps an act which should be punished. And then we go on to read of the negotiations that go on between Hamor, the father of Shem, and between the sons of Yaakov. Note the fact that in this whole story, Yaakov is extremely passive. The only mention of Yaakov is what we discussed in verse 5. Yaakov heard what happened, and he was silent until his sons come. It is very striking that Yaakov is in the background and allows his sons to be the ones to do the negotiations. And I will come back to this later on. So let's go to the negotiations. Hamor puts his cards on the table. He says, "My son Shechem desires your daughter. Give him to her to be his wife." This is verse 8. Furthermore, Hamor wants to see this as part of a much larger package of the integration of the family of Yaakov with the people of Shechem. And he packages it in a way which is very inviting. Marry our people. You will give us the daughters. You will take our daughters. Verse 10. You will settle down among us. The land will be before you. Settle. Engage in commerce. Find your foothold, your achuzah, which we've discussed on a previous podcast, among us. The offer seems to be very magnanimous. It goes far beyond the question of Shechem marrying Dinah. It has to do with the total integration of the family of Yaakov in the midst of the people of Shechem. And the way it's presented is, it offers them unlimited possibilities. They're invited to come and settle. They're invited to now become, find their inheritance among those people. They will have the option of taking the daughters of Shechem, of giving their daughters. It seems to be very much an offer which they can't refuse. As I said, very magnanimous. But as we read it, the question is this a very good sales pitch which Hamor is offering? Is it a way of enticing them to now come in their midst so that on the one hand, Shechem can get his desire, which is to marry Dinah, and on the other hand, ultimately the people of Shechem will benefit by their integration. It's very interesting that when this initial proposal is made, that the brothers do not react. And then Shechem feels the necessity to speak. And he says to them, in verse 11, "Let me find favor in your eyes. Whatever you say to me, I will do. Jack up the bride dowry. I will give whatever you ask of me. Give me this young woman to be my wife." And then the response of the brothers in verse 13 is given bimirma, in deception. And it says, and they speak to the one who defiled their sister, Dinah. So the Torah is already telling us, with respect to the brothers, that their negotiations are not being done in good faith. From the very outset, what they're saying is deceptive, is treacherous. And what is uppermost in their mind is that their sister has been violated. And what do they add to the negotiating table? Circumcision. And this is what we find from verse 14 on. They say, it is an embarrassment, a sign of reproach to us, to give our daughter to somebody who is uncircumcised. And then, if you want our daughter, see to it that all the males are circumcised. And then we will do as you say. We will give you our daughters. We will take your daughters. We will settle with you. We will become one nation. So that they are, on the one hand, reiterating the offer that was made to them. And where they make it very clear that the goal is to become one people. But in order to do that, the people of Shechem must circumcise. At face value, what they're asking for is, we would like you to become integrated into our value system. But as we mentioned before, the Torah is telling us that all of this is a deception. And of course, in verse 18, they give them the alternative option. If they're not interested in circumcising, then let them give Dinah back, and they will go. If we were to stop here, we could say that there's a very real imbalance in what's happening. It seems that Shechem and his father are acting in good faith, have an honest desire to integrate Yaakov and his family in their midst, and the response of the sons of Yaakov is one of deception. As you have seen on previous podcasts, I like to also read between the lines. And perhaps, maybe this is with my modern sensitivities, there is something missing here. It would seem to me that an apology is in hand. It would seem to me that Shechem should have come to the family of Yaakov and said to them, I am sorry for what I did to your daughter. I recognize what I did wrong, but I would like to now make amends for it. Maybe it could have been taken even one step further. Maybe Shechem could have said, take your daughter. Let us now negotiate. I don't want to negotiate with you while she is in my house. That is very unfair. I bring these points up because although it seems that Shechem has had a change of heart, and although it seems that they are very sincere in their negotiations, it also seems that they don't appreciate the severity of the act that's been done, the criminal nature, the offense, the pain that has been brought upon the family of Jacob. And as we read in the continuation, Hamor and Shechem are very receptive to the terms of the sons of Yaakov. In verse 18 and 19 and 20, they immediately want to implement this. But in order to do so, they need to have the consent of the people in their city. And note, when they speak to the people in their city, they package it in a slightly different way. They present it to the people in verse 21. Jacob's family is at peace with us. They will settle in the land. They will bring commerce to the land. There's enough land to go around to be for all of us. But then there's a slight change in what was mentioned earlier. We will take their daughters to be our wives. We will give them our daughters. Now, one could say that Shechem and Hamor are just very good salesmen. They know how to market their product. If they're talking to their own people, they want to make it sound very attractive to their people. And so they say to them, we will have the option whose daughters we will give and whose daughters we will take. They tell them about the circumcision. But in verse 23, they also say to them, do you realize that all of their sheep and all of their cattle and all of their possessions, it will be ours, but we have to agree to the term of Brit Milah. And when we do, they will settle among us, and we will have everything which is theirs. I mentioned earlier, when Shechem and Hamor come to the brothers, are they acting in good faith or not? It is clear that the line which they give their own people is much different than what they say to the Yaakov and his family. So what do they really think? Are they really interested in becoming one people with Yaakov and his family? Or is this just a ploy in order to be able to get all of their possessions and to ultimately assimilate them within their framework? It is hard to know. And then we come to the conclusion of the story. Evidently, Hamor and Shechem are very respected and make a very good case. And we're told in verse 24 that all the people in the city circumcise themselves. And then the response of Yaakov's children is immediately following. On the third day, when the people in the city who have circumcised are in pain, Shimon and Levi, the sons of Yaakov, the brothers of Dinah, take their sword and they kill all the males. And in particular, they kill Hamor, Shechem his son, and they take Dinah away from that house and they go. But even more than that, they ransack the city in verse 27. The city that defiled their sister, their sheep, their cattle, their donkeys, everything that's in the city they take. Verse 29. All of their possessions, their children, their women, they take into captivity. And as I said, they ransack the city. Shimon and Levi's response is devastating. And it's very interesting that there's an argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides, which Nachmanides brings down in his commentary on verse 13. How could Shimon and Levi do this? Maimonides, in fact, says they were justified in what they did. And he says that all of the people in the city were liable the death penalty. And this is because What Shechem did was an unacceptable act. It was a violation of the seven laws of Noah. And it's very interesting that the violation is not in terms of sexual immorality, but the violation is in terms of stealing. Dina was stolen. She was held as a captive. One could perhaps say Dina, in the act of rape, was stolen. Her human dignity was stolen. And according to Jewish law, when non-Jews do not observe the seven laws of Noah, they are liable to the death penalty. And Maimonides says, Shechem should have been brought to trial for what he did and put to death by his own people. That is also one of the laws, seven laws of Noah, to set up a legal system to enforce the other laws. And when that didn't happen, everyone in the city is now seen as being an accomplice to the crime, and hence should also be put to death. Nachmanides disagrees. On the purely legal basis, Nachmanides says that not putting somebody on trial does not make them an accomplice to the crime. So that even if Shechem should be put to death for what he did, that doesn't make it acceptable or even mandatory to put everyone to death. It would seem to be that even if you go by the position of Maimonides, what they're doing is excessive. Because not only do they put all the males to death, but they also take their possessions. They take their women and children into captivity. They pillage the city. To go back to Nachmanides, if in fact Shimon and Levi did not have a legal justification for doing what they did, so how do you explain it? And Nachmanides says they are avenging the act that was perpetrated against their sister. Perhaps one can see this as a way of showing these people a lesson, that such a thing should never be done again, in no way can be tolerated. A message to whoever's left in Shechem and a message to the people around them. If you engage in these types of practices, this is what will happen to you. Shimon and Levi are motivated by a principle. The principle is an act of zealotry. Zealotry, which is now taking a stand, a defiant stand, against what was done. Saying rape, hostage taking, cannot be tolerated. It is only at the end, in the aftermath of what they do, that Yaakov responds. And Yaakov responds by saying to them, you have caused trouble to me, or you have made me ugly, to make me repulsive to the land's inhabitants. And I am few in number, and they will gather against me, attack me, and I and my household will be destroyed. It would seem to be that Yaakov's response is not a response in principle, but a response based on political, military considerations. It is a response of someone who's afraid. You've done something which in the end could ultimately boomerang and lead to our destruction. How could you do such a thing to endanger all of us? Later on in chapter 50, before Yaakov dies, he has a different response. When he is giving the blessings to his brothers, excuse me, this is chapter 49, verses 5 through 7. When Yaakov is looking at Shimon and Levi, he describes them as brothers whose instruments are instruments of destruction. And he tries to somehow justify himself in saying, I was not in their council when in their anger they killed a man. And in verse 7 he says, cursed is their anger because it is fierce, and their wrath because it is harsh. Before Yaakov dies, there's no reason for him to be concerned, to be worried about the reaction of his surroundings. So that the statement which he makes is a statement of principle. It is very clear that Yaakov condemns what Shimon and Levi did as being an impassioned act which led to killing, which was fierce, harsh, which is to be cursed. And yet, if we go back to the story, there's a problem over here. The problem is Yaakov's silence until the very end. And I would perhaps like to end on this note. In last year's podcast, I spoke about the difficulty of Yaakov to take a stand. Maybe I should say to stand up to a world around him which is hostile. To be able to stand up for a principle. We perhaps could have expected that when Yaakov hears of what happened, that Yaakov should have been the one who takes the lead. Yaakov should have rallied his family, gone to Shechem, demanded the return of his daughter. And if perhaps Yaakov was not in a position to make that demand, then maybe he should have been the one to handle the negotiations. In the same way that he was able to devise a scheme to somehow diffuse the wrath of his brother, he sent him a present. He made preparations for war in the beginning of the parsha. He should have done a parallel thing in restoring his daughter. But Yaakov once again plays a passive role. And instead he leaves it to his sons to be the ones to take a stand. The sons, in a way, act like their father. They're deceptive. They're not upfront. And perhaps this is the most significant aspect of their crime, to not be upfront and tell them, we want our sister back. What you did was a defilement. Perhaps the situation could have been solved by finding a way to get her out of the palace. But there are two things which are problematic with the behavior of Yaakov's sons. If Yaakov is overly passive, they are overly zealous. No matter how you want to explain it, their reaction was exaggerated. In the best of situations, they should not have killed anybody. In the worst of situations, they should have killed Shem. But it should not have gone beyond that. This is a problem of zealotry, which becomes excessive, which is unleashed with a fury, and can become devastating. But in this story, there's another aspect which is equally problematic, and that is using Brit Milah, which is a religious act, which is at the core of their identity as Jews, of their covenantal relationship with God, using it as a trick in order to be able to kill all the people in the city. This is a classic example of what is called a desecration of God's name. To take something which is an expression of one's devotion to God, and then to use it in a deceptive way to bring about someone else's destruction, seems to undermine their whole value system. It is interesting that somehow Shimon and Levi still remain part of the Jewish people, despite what they did. And in fact, we see that later on, when Yaakov blesses them, / curses them, in the section which I mentioned to you from chapter 49, verse 7, Yaakov says, their anger is cursed. And he says, and I will divide them. I will divide them among Jacob, and I will scatter them among Israel. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, in his commentary, makes an interesting observation, and I will leave you with this thought. He says zealotry can be something positive. Zealotry can be something which is absolutely destructive. In our story, Shimon and Levi do an act of zealotry which is destructive. And hence Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch says, if they had been given land, if they had been given a power base, if they had been given any type of political position among the Jewish people, their nature of zealotry could have led them to engaging in battles that would have been absolutely destructive. Yaakov tried to channel their nature and to put it in a constructive context by dividing them among the Jewish people, which is understood to mean that they did not get their own inheritance of land, by stripping them of any type of power base. Yaakov was in effect trying to neutralize the destructive capacity of their zealotry. The flip side of it being, when zealotry is not coming from a position of power, it can actually be very positive. It could be that in circumstances, that it is important to have a zealot. It is important to have people who will be prepared to take a stand, who will not run away, who will not be apathetic, or perhaps tacit accomplices to injustices that are perpetrated. And Rabbi Hirsch says that when the Jews, for example, are in the diaspora, when they're being persecuted, when they're being stripped of their human dignity, dehumanized, it is important to have a zealot who will stand up, restore their spirit, be able to rally them to survive in a horrific reality. So zealotry can be something which can help restore human dignity and correct injustices when done in proper doses. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schwager. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email via podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.